my name is Michael Lamb. I was previously a full-time professor at the Rochester Institute of Technology, but have recently shifted over to the SETI Institute. And I've been working on this since I was actually an undergrad for a little bit and then into grad school with the North American Nanohertz Observatory for Gravitational Waves, or NanoGrav. That's my collaboration. And I'm really excited to tell you all about our results, which are not quite new because they came out this past summer, but still relatively new, where we found strong evidence for a low-frequency gravitational wave background. And so that's what I'm going to tell you all about today. And I'm going to start by showing you the actual evidence. And I'm going to get back into these plots a little bit later. But here's our evidence, and it's twofold pieces. One is that we observe lots of different objects, pulsars, throughout our galaxy. And in all of the pulsars, the remaining signals that we don't model out all behave in the same way. So they all have this kind of same sound to them, the same amplitude and the same spectrum. And then on top of it, the thing that really pulled this all together for the evidence is that they behave in the correlated way due to the quadrupolar nature of gravitational waves. And so with both of those pieces, we feel very strongly that we have found the low-frequency gravitational wave background, which is very exciting. Like I said, I'm going to get more into this and build up to it as we go through. And originally, when people started looking for low-frequency gravitational waves, the idea was that they would be coming from supermassive black hole binaries, which are spread throughout the universe. Every galaxy has a supermassive black hole at the center, and we see galaxies merge, so those black holes should also merge and then produce gravitational waves. And that was the idea, that those would produce the gravitational waves that we would observe with our ensemble of pulsars. And I'll spoil it a little bit and say that we're actually not sure that's what we found just yet, or we don't have definitive evidence of that so far, so we don't want to make those claims. All right, so like I said, I'm a member of NanoGrav, the North American Nanohertz Observatory for Gravitational Waves, and have been so for many, many years. I'm currently a working group co-chair, and I'm on the management team, and I'm just heavily involved. But we've had a lot of growth, especially in the last year, but even before the last year, where we have almost 200 members, actually, I think over 200 members now, at lots and lots of different institutions, primarily based in North America, primarily US and Canada. We do have members throughout throughout the world, though, and we also have collaborators in what's called the International Pulsar Timing Array collaboration, which is this collaboration of collaborations that exists out there, and it also works together. So we are one of those collaborations, but I'm only going to tell you really about NanoGrav's results today, which had the most significant evidence. And not only are we based in North America with its personnel, we use North American telescopes. And the four telescopes that we use are shown here. So unfortunately, several years ago, the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico collapsed. But Arecibo was a significant contributor to our sensitivity because of how large that telescope was. So that was there. In West Virginia, there's the Green Bank Telescope, which is the largest fully steerable object on the planet. So you take a football field, and it can completely rotate and move up and down. And it's very, very quiet as it does so. And that also contributed a lot of our sensitivity. In our current data set, the one that I'm going to present today, we use the Very Large Array, which are these 27 dishes out in New Mexico. And then for our upcoming data set that we're starting to work on now, we're going to include data from CHIME, which is a radio telescope in Penticton, British Columbia.
Can I ask a quick question?
Absolutely.
In collaboration with collaborations, was supposedly writing a joint paper. Is that happening, coming out?
It is slowly being worked on, yes. So the results were that all of us would publish independently. So we all had our independent results, which was a nice cross-check between groups. And the idea is that we are trying to we are doing things in two stages. One is a paper which has been submitted to just show more consistency analyzing the three sets separately but together. The other one is a full data combination. That is just taking time because it's very, very complicated, and I'll show exactly how complicated. I know I was joking earlier, I know this is an institute for theoretical physics, so I'm going to show you some observations, as it should go. It's just a very, very long and difficult process because there's not only all of these telescopes, but lots of other telescopes around the world, all with their idiosyncrasies and all with just lots of problems. So it is being actively worked on, but it's just taking a while. Yeah. Good question. You should feel free to stop me at any time, and I will happily attempt to answer. All right, so that's NanoGrav. And why we do this is, well, you know, if you look at the night sky with your eyes, well, actually with a camera because this is much better than your eyes, you see something that looks like this. You get one snapshot of the universe. You see the gas and the dust and the dust of the Milky Way. You see the stars. And I like showing this image. I don't know if anyone has seen this image. This is what the radio sky looks like. And so you see that there's other wisps and blobs. And the very cool part about this is that each one of these dots is not a star, but it's a quasar. It's an AGN. So the sky looks very different when you look at different wavelengths of light. And I probably don't have to impress that upon you, that if you look at all the different wavelengths of light, you get quite a lovely picture of the Milky Way. Right? But you still don't get the complete picture of the Milky Way. I should have added the neutrino picture into here from recently because I think that is so cool. And unfortunately was announced the same day we announced our evidence for gravitational waves, so it was a little bit overshadowed. But I really think that is an awesome picture. So we're seeing the Milky Way in another messenger, right? And we have yet other messengers, gravitational waves, and just like the electromagnetic spectrum, the gravitational waves also span a spectrum. And there are sort of four traditional types of experiments that have been looking for gravitational waves. There are some more that are at very, very high frequencies that people are thinking about, but not that have really come to fruition so far. And so we've got frequency on this axis, and the ground-based interferometers are things like LIGO, Virgo, and Kagra, and they've been doing amazing work over the last seven or so, well, many decades, but since they've announced the detection of gravitational waves, the last seven or so years with lots and lots and lots of observations of mergers, merging supermassive black hole binaries, neutron star binaries, et cetera. In about 10 years from now, we should expect space-based interferometers. Those will be absolutely phenomenal given the sensitivity understanding that we have now, but they don't exist right now. So we can't say anything about this part of the gravitational wave spectrum. And then pulsar timing arrays sit here at low frequency. So we're the North American Nanohertz Observatory for gravitational waves. And one nanohertz corresponds to a period of about 30 years. So we are looking for the nanohertz to microhertz gravitational waves. So you're looking at periods of weeks, months, years, and decades. So it's necessarily a decades-long experiment that you have to run for because the periods of these objects are that you're looking for are that long. Okay. And to build our detector, we're going to build a galactic scale detector. I'll show you an image later of exactly how much of the galaxy we have covered. And we're using neutron stars. So neutron stars are these objects. They're all very small. They're very compact. They're very precisely timed. They rotate around with the beams offset. And as they spin around, we see pulses from them. And they're very, very, very precise objects. Precise and accurate clocks, I should say. And for our experiments, not only are pulsars themselves really good clocks, but we need the best of the best clocks. So we have here what's called the PP dot diagram, so the spin period of the pulsar, and then this period derivative, how much it's slowing down due to loss of kinetic energy into luminous energy. And most of the pulsars live up here. Those are the canonical pulsars. Some of them die off. They get spun up as millisecond pulsars, these recycled pulsars down here, with very short periods and very small period derivatives. So they're ultra spin stable. And even from the millisecond pulsars, we need the best of the best of those. So we only take about a quarter of that sample. There are millisecond pulsars out there that are not good enough clocks. Because what we need to do is we get a pulse, an average pulse that looks something like that up top. These are individual pulses down here. So this is real data of mine. And the pulses are all over the place. And if you work out a millisecond spin periods, and then what the width is of that actual pulse feature, that's the tick of your clock, you need to be able to measure to about 1/1000th of that tick. And that's a very, very hard problem. So one that we've been able to overcome, but I'll show you why we need to get to those precisions in a little bit. Yes?
What's the second peak?
Ah, yes. So the beams have structures. So we have this very basic picture of here's one beam and another beam. So many pulsars, they have what's called an interpulse, where 180 degrees out of phase, you see a blip. You see the main pulse, and then 180 degrees later, you see another blip. And millisecond pulsars, lots of people who work on the actual emission stuff hate looking at millisecond pulsars because they don't behave nicely at all. So you have these models about how these canonical pulsars, their pulse structures are. This one has these polarization features, so we can model it this way. And this one has this, so we can model it this way. And all of our millisecond pulsars, I don't say all of them, some of them look kind of normal. They look like a pulse. And lots of them look absolutely crazy. They have all these multiple peaks all around pulse phase. And I don't even come close to trying to explain why that should be the case, because it is way beyond my pay grade. But for our purposes, what we care about is because we're trying to time tag when these pulses arrive, we need very sharp features. And we need the actual time span here to be very small. That's where the millisecond pulsars also come into play.
Do these pulse shapes evolve over time, or are they stable?
For most of them, they are very stable. Some of them will change over time. There's at least one case, but I think maybe a few others, of precession, where actually the precession of the beam due to the companion is causing it to actually change shape ever so slightly, but in a kind of slow, systematic way over decades that you can model out. There is one pulsar, which has been a huge pain to us because it is one of our most sensitive pulsars in this experiment, which suddenly changed shape 2 years ago. And we do not understand why. And it appears to be recovering over the time scale of years. We don't actually know if it's recovering to the old shape or if it's actually asymptoting to a slightly different shape. So there's some kind of magnetospheric reconfiguration that happened that's been constrained to have happened within 1 day. Like, 1 day to the next, it just changed.
But the period is the same.
But in this case, the period is the same. So it's not like a traditional glitch for young pulsars. So 2 years ago, I would have said, yes, all pulsars, more or less, have stable pulse shapes. And we do not know if that's actually true anymore. That's a good question. Yes?
Is this a clean picture, or is there any dispersion?
In this case, dispersion. I know the dispersion on this pulsar, so that's been removed from this pulse. Yeah. Okay. And I want to, I like to impress upon, when I give talks, impress upon the audience exactly how accurate and precise these measurements are that we're getting. So I've picked one pulsar. This is one of my favorites, one of our best. But so I'm sort of cherry picking it, but all of our pulsars behave sort of similarly. So in the middle of our data set, because we reference our spin period to roughly the middle of our data set, the spin period of this pulsar was this number of milliseconds, where the 2 is the error bar on that 7 at the bottom. So it's one of the most precise measurements one can make. I know, because I know what the period derivative of this pulsar, I know how much that's changing, how much the period is getting larger over time, the pulsar is slowing down. So the last digit changes by 1 every 12 minutes or so. That digit over there, that 0, changes by 1 every 226 years. So if you really need to memorize the spin period of this pulsar, you only need the first couple of digits. And I know that between that time in the middle of our data set and the start of this seminar, the pulsar has completed this many rotations. And so that's the power of pulsar timing, the pulsar timing technique, which allows it to do lots of tests of fundamental physics, including finding gravitational waves, is that we can accurately monitor every single rotation of every one of our pulsars. Yes?
And how does that then? I was just comparing it to the accuracy of an atomic clock.
So, they are comparable.
Yeah, so with, you know, in terms of the errors, you know, which is the more
What's the Allen variance?
It's at the like 10, I mean, it's at the like 10 to the minus 15 level. If you look at the Allen's variance, you can look at the Allen variance of individual pulsars and let's say atomic clocks, and they are comparable. And this is, I've gotten asked this question before, so this is a fun like time scale question for the people who care about that. There's an ensemble of, I believe, 400 or so atomic clocks, and that's what sets our time standard here on like that we use. And atomic clocks, right, they have a certain accuracy over a certain amount of time. So that's what's setting the Allen variance there. And pulsars, in general, are comparable. Atomic clocks are a little bit better on average. Like the average of those 400 is better than the average of our 80 or so pulsars. But they are pretty comparable. So you can start to do things like make a pulsar-based time scale and try to compare that and see where the differences are, and it gets in the weeds when you're trying to say time tag something to something else, which is comparable in accuracy. Yes, it is a fun problem that not a lot of people care about, but just enough people care about that, and sometimes worries me.
Do you need a more precise clock on Earth to reach this sensitivity, or let's say you find a pulsar that is actually better than all the atomic clocks that you have here. Do you need, are you limited by the atomic clock here on Earth? Because you use that to actually tag the pulsars here on Earth.
I think the answer is no, because you wouldn't be comparing pulse to pulse when you're defining that time scale. You actually are like defining that time scale based on the long-term monitoring of that pulsar. And then using, right, you're using that thread to now compare against.
But so, do we not have terrestrial laboratory clocks that are at least like 1,000 times better than that?
Over short time scales, you mean?
Oh, short time scales, that's true. Because I was thinking of the Allen variance, because on the Allen variance, this is like 10 to the minus 15. I thought we had like 10 to the minus 18 clocks.
Yeah, that might be the number. I forget. So the problem is one of time scale, and like if you're defining this time standard, and you can say I can hold this clock to be very precise, but for a year, that doesn't help you define the time standard that humans need in general for, you know, nanosecond trading and to launch a missile from here to there to make sure it lands in the right place and all of that precision stuff. So you have clocks that are better, but for a much shorter time. And that's the trade-off. Yeah. So when I say atomic clocks, I'm talking about the ones, and I forget exactly which ones, that are, you know, you're talking about the decade-long time scale. Compare this decade-long clock to the decade-long atomic clock that you would use. And that typically is what goes into like the BIPM measurements.
Is the reason why you don't actually need a better terrestrial clock to time tag all of these because you're going to be, you just need unique and consistent tags because you're going to compare this pulsar to that pulsar to that pulsar? Or could you do this if you didn't have a particularly good, if we had a much worse terrestrial clock, could you still do that?
Yeah, you can. So that's where the pulsar-based time scale is, you have to make the initial measurements based on the time tagging that we currently do, but then that would be a completely independent reference point. Well, I don't want to say completely independent. It's independent enough where now you can just compare pulsar to pulsar instead of using pulsar. You can add a new pulsar in and say, let me compare it against that time standard, not the atomic clock time standard that one has. Yeah. So if all of our atomic clocks go down, I wouldn't say it's the easier thing, but then you point lots of radio telescopes at pulsars and somehow you can reconstruct everything. That's a very roundabout way of doing it, but one could do it that way. Yeah. Okay, so it is powerful. More fun with just this one particular object because J1909 is in a binary with a white dwarf companion. That's very typical for our millisecond pulsars. Not all of them are like that, but the vast majority are like that. And I know what the binary period is, so I know it's completed that many orbits. This specific binary is the smallest measured eccentricity. So it's the most perfectly measured circle, astrophysical circle that we know of. So it has this eccentricity. So the fun fact is when you work out the math, you know that even though the orbit has a radius close to the radius of the sun, semi-major axis about the radius of the sun, the difference between the semi-major and semi-minor axis is 3.4 microns. So we're able to get that out of our pulsar timing measurement, and that's just for one system, and we're observing lots of systems. So we're observing currently around 80 pulsars. 67 went into the data set that I'm going to talk about today. So you can do lots and lots and lots of really precise tests. And we need that because the effects of gravitational waves are very, very small. So you can hand wave your way through a bunch of math that gets you to pretty close to the right answer, that the strain, which is the fractional change in the distance, should be for our objects, so if you work through and go through, should be around 10 to the minus 15 is the strain that we're measuring for supermassive black hole binaries. The distances are not quite megaparsec. They're much further than that. But the separations are also on the order of milliparsecs where we are observing them. And the frequencies that we observe at for these kind of supermassive black hole binaries at these separations are going to be in the nanohertz regime. So again, in reality, they're going to be closer to maybe 10-ish nanohertz or something like that. So that's what motivates an experiment that if you want to go look at supermassive black hole binaries, they would exist in they would produce gravitational waves of those strains and of those frequencies. And the question is, can you measure those strains? And the answer is yes. What you would need is that the fractional change in distance, so the actual delta in the distance, if you had a time span, a light travel time of about 10 years that you're measuring over, that would accumulate a distance change of about 100 meters. Or equivalently in time units, about 300 nanoseconds. Which means that if I can time my pulsars, if I can time tag the pulses to within sub-microsecond precision and accuracy, then I'm able to measure the changes in length due to gravitational waves at these frequencies. Okay, so I need to get down to 300 or so nanoseconds. And in fact, we have many, many of our objects that are 300, 100 nanoseconds, even better, 50 nanoseconds. So we have lots of those clocks that exist out there, which should tell you that we should be able to measure to strains at about 10 to the minus 15. And for reference, for LIGO and Virgo, their loudest are about 10 to the minus 21. So this is a million times stronger. But it's, again, it's a completely different frequency regime. So LIGO and Virgo can't see what we see and vice versa. Okay? And again, just for the sense of scale, that also means that we're keeping track of the relative position of a neutron star to well within the radius of a neutron star. So all of these neutron stars are sitting out there, and we need to know where they are and tracking, relatively speaking, where they're moving to well within the size of that object. Okay. So how do we build our timing models? We have to take into account lots of different effects before we even get to gravitational waves. So the first thing you have to do is say, well, pulses are arriving to us from this pulsar, and we measure a spin period, a spin period derivative. But the telescope on the Earth is moving around our solar system. So we have to take into account exactly where the telescope is on the Earth and where the Earth is in its orbit around the sun, because this light travel time is 500 seconds, and if you need to get down to 300 nanoseconds, you need to make sure you're taking into account all of the different objects in our solar system. And in fact, several years ago, we ran up against the problem where we were seeing things because the ephemerides from JPL were not as sensitive. They didn't have precise enough positions for planets like Jupiter and Saturn. And so we had to work with them on that to get better. And thankfully, the Juno mission was orbiting around Jupiter right at that time. Most of our millisecond pulsars are in binaries, like I said before. And we can't go to that system to make those measurements of what's going on. We just have to measure it from the data, where it is in the orbit around the binary. There's lots of cool tests of gravity that can be done in these systems. And we have done many of those tests ourselves or other pulsar timing array collaborators around the world. But I don't have time to get into all of those here today. But there's lots of really fun tests of fundamental physics that you can do and provide the strongest constraints on, for example, modified gravity. On top of the fact that we have these two systems, they're moving through the galaxy in some random direction, and we have to measure those. Effects like dispersion, but many others, scattering, refraction, et cetera, are present in the interstellar medium, because the interstellar medium is not a vacuum. It's full of gas. And that causes, the dispersion is the largest effect, and it causes the longer wavelengths, the redder light, to arrive at our telescopes later. And so if I need to time tag pulses, assigning a number to which pulse is which over here is very easy. And it's a lot harder over here. And so we need to take that into account. And we're able to do so relatively well. And on top of all of that, for one arm of our detector, and every one of our arms is different, because all of our pulsars are in different systems and all of the lines of sight are different, on top of that, we have our gravitational waves, which are perturbing when the pulses, it's perturbing space-time, so it'll perturb when pulses arrive at our telescope, either early or late. And so it's a tough problem. And you know, the power of our modeling is such that, well, I can, this is a little bit more introductory, but I can go through this quickly, is that we need a model that predicts exactly when pulses arrive. So in that case, the pulses are very uniform. If they're not very uniform, they don't match very well. We need to figure out when they arrive early or late. And we do that, we compare when they do arrive to when we think they arrive, and we compute residuals, in this case, timing residuals. So here's an example of one pulsar. This is the pulsar that underwent the shape change. So this is a little bit older data. We have data that, well, comes up till even today, but 2+ years that went into the data set that I'm going to talk about. You see residuals, the times of arrivals, measured from lots of different observatories and receiver systems, and it's a very, very complicated mess. And embedded in here somewhere is the imprint of gravitational waves, and for all of our pulsars. So probably the easiest one to think about first is what a continuous wave looks like, and that is if you have just one single binary, two supermassive black holes that are orbiting around each other, they're going to stretch and compress space-time in a periodic way. And so we're going to look for sinusoidal-ish patterns in our data. It's not entirely sinusoidal-ish because it depends on the orientation of where the binary is with respect to the pulsar Earth arm and how that the gravitational waves differ at the pulsar versus at the Earth. So it's not entirely sinusoidal-ish, but we can figure that out. But what we expected to see, we've known this for many years now, what we expected to see first, unlike in the case of LIGO, was not a single system. It was, in fact, the stochastic background is what we would see first, which is the sum of 100,000 or a million nearby, quote unquote, nearby systems, supermassive black hole binary systems in the universe. And the sums of all of those sinusoidal-ish waveforms produces this sort of red noise process that exists in our data and for all of our pulsars. And if we look at what those red noise processes do, how the residuals, if we compare the residuals between pulsars, you can imagine that if we had all these pulsars in the same direction of the sky, and a gravitational wave passed through and space stretched, then all of the pulses from those pulsars would arrive late, from every single one of them. And if space compressed, then all of the pulses would arrive early. And if instead of being 0 degrees separated on the sky, there were 10 degrees or 20 degrees or 30 degrees, there would be still some correlation. And that correlation is given here, so the angle between the pulsars and the amount of correlation. This is what we call the Hellings and Downs curve, after the two radio astronomers who computed it. And so that's the kind of thing that would be the smoking gun of finding our gravitational waves. One is that they would have sort of a consistent red noise, correlated noise, in the residuals, and that they would be correlated in this kind of a pattern. And this correlation pattern is due entirely to the expectation from general relativity. I think I basically have said all of that, and I should have said that here. So if we correlate between the different pulsars, I will say that we can and have performed other tests of polarization modes and in our pulsar timing array by looking at deviations from this Hollings and Downs curve. So if you have a different metric theory of gravity, that would actually produce a different pattern, and then that's one that you can look for to then limit what's going on there. All right. So here's an animation, or here's a still from an animation, of our pulsar timing array detector on a schematic of the Milky Way. So we're not quite the size of the full galaxy, but we're a decent fraction of it. So when I say we have a galactic scale detector, I feel like we mean a galactic scale detector, that we have pulsars that are spread out among multiple arms of our galaxy. And for our current analysis, we've observed 67 of them that we talked about. So they're spread around the neighboring many kiloparsecs. And as time has gone on, we've done a lot of things to improve our data sets. So we've had lots of data sets that have come out before this. Each point here is an observation at a given radio frequency. And so you can see that we've added more pulsars. The number of pulsars are along this axis. That means more correlation pairs that we can build up to, our Hellings and Downs statistic over. So we are correlating lots and lots and lots more pairs. So the number of pulsars adds in quite a lot. The amount of time you observe adds in quite a lot. And then one axis that you can't quite see here, but the instrumentation has improved. So we've observed more radio frequency from the pulsar. That's more signal. So we can get better measurements of the times of arrival. So our data set has become incredibly large.
Did you say what the color?
There are different radio frequencies that we observe at. We try to tune where we can get the best timing precision from. And it just depends on every given pulsar, which makes the data set that much more complicated to deal with. Yeah.
Sorry.
Mm-hmm. Go for it.
So if you wanted to use if you wanted to use this network of pulsars to find individual sources, as you were saying,
mm-hmm.
would the angular resolution with which you could localize the source be something like lambda over d, where d is like the distance between the pulsars, or is it?
That's a good question. I have never thought of it in those terms. It is probably something like that. I will say that our angular resolution at the moment is very poor. I will show you upper limits on the anisotropy later. So it's not an actual map because we don't have a map, but that's what we're going to. And the resolution is kind of like, there's more power over there in this blob than over here or over here. Right? Over time, you can ask the question, what is our resolution going to get to? And it's never going to be as good as, I don't think it's going to be as good as the error regions, for example, for LIGO, Virgo, Cagra. It'll be worse than that. So you still have a very large selection of the sky. And that's why, for example, there's different approaches where, going to get into this slide, where we want to combine with electromagnetic observations. And so you can do this from two different directions. You can say, well, if I know I have a candidate supermassive black hole binary from over there, I can tune my detector to fix those positions and other properties about the system. You've reduced your dimensions of parameter space by quite a lot, and so that helps you in gaining sensitivity. So we've seen that. Otherwise, you're doing this kind of a blind search where you say, I have some source over there, or I have more power over there. That tells you, okay, here's all of these electromagnetic surveys you have to go through and sift through, but that gives you potentially thousands of candidates that now you have to hack away at to say, okay, what's the right periodicity or what are the right other qualities of the system? So the resolution is going to, unless we know exactly where it is, the just general resolution is going to be pretty poor, like tens of degrees at best. Maybe sub 10 degrees at some point, but not in the next couple of years by any means. Yeah, so that is the idea, is that we want to go toward a regime where we're really producing multi-messenger science. And like I said, the original picture and why you do this in the first place is we want to understand over cosmic history how supermassive black holes have evolved and merged and come together. And we see pictures, lots of pictures of merging galaxies and the cores of them coming together, but we don't have any definitive evidence of what happens afterwards. So what are the environments like in those systems? That all comes from, not all comes from, but a lot of that will come from gravitational wave measurements. Okay, so where are we with our evidence? So the first piece of this is something we knew about in our previous data set and we announced before. That is of a common process. In all of our pulsars, there is correlated red noise that is statistically similar amongst all of the pulsars. It has the right amplitude. They all have the right same amplitude and same spectral index, which looks something like this. So you have frequency and you have the amplitude over there. And that evidence has only grown over time. And then actually you can go backwards in time and see what our evidence was and see that it was there and has grown as we expect over time. So the Bayes factor, so it's not quite the odds ratio, but you know, to give you some sense of your betting odds, in our current data set was 10 to the 12th. So that's an extremely large Bayes factor to say, yes, there is definitely correlated common red noise amongst all of our pulsars. They all sound the same. They're all behaving the same way.
Is the vertical height of these things is that one sigma, two sigma, or what does that mean?
The gray, you're talking about the gray violin?
Violin
plots, yeah. Those are what we call free spectrum analysis. So besides just looking for fixing a power law or fixing some shape, we can say, how much power is there at this one Fourier frequency, right? So you lose sensitivity because you're only looking at that one frequency. And then, yeah, that's a one sigma on each of the individual frequencies there. So we have done both of those sets of analyses. So for example, here, this measurement here is like saying, let's look at for the sine waves of exactly that power, of exactly that frequency, and what is the amplitude that you get? And you get that one. Whereas the dashed line is not a fit to the gray. The dashed black line, or actually the blue line as well, is if you constrain the power to fall along a power law in that way.
Maybe I'm not understanding. So the gray violin, actually, okay, like, so it's the vertical height means the one sigma uncertainty region on the power at that frequency.
Yeah. Right, independently measured.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, right. But the frequency should be roughly uncorrelated, right?
Right.
So then for each band, they're all one consistent. I think so. Each frequency is like one sigma consistent with zero. Is that what you're saying?
No, because these are. I mean, this is almost no probability over here.
It's like one sigma. I thought you said.
Sorry. It's the one sigma. The PDF is drawn at a 90 degree angle. Right, so it's the PDF. What is the probability on the amplitude? And the amplitude is between, it's almost -6.5 or something like that.
Those bands have to be terminated at 3 sigma or something like that.
Oh, it's 3 sigma.
Well, you just look at the PDF, right? So if 1 sigma is going to be in the fat region, 2.
Yeah, if 1 sigma is over here, right? So 2 and 3 in log space, right? It won't get you all the way down to 0 or down to.
Oh, so is the horizontal supposed to be the PDF?
The width is the PDF.
You're turning the PDF on its side.
Oh.
Right. So the PDF is here and saying the probability of the amplitude for at this frequency is like -6.5 or something like that.
Got it. Okay.
Okay. Sorry.
And by the time you get above 10 nanohertz, the right hand side of this, then a lot of things are consistent with zero.
Yes, there are definitely individual frequencies that are consistent. Yeah.
Is there a particular reason why the PDFs are cut off at the top and not at the bottom?
It's a good question that I don't know.
Normally, you cut these things off at some finite given number of sigma, and it's a log plot.
So you're saying that the tail of the, say, that first PDF at the lowest frequency,
is the tail goes farther than the.
Yeah, we. That's a good question because it's not set on the prior range. The prior range, there's a prior in the top, but it goes quite low. And I think that there is a tail where there must be some samples down there, like a couple of, you know, just a few number of samples to give you that, and not at the top.
Right. So is it you're not sampling at the top of the end of the PDF?
Right. Yeah, I think that's right.
But it's much easier to roll out large power as opposed to a small.
Exactly. Power. Yeah, exactly. But still, so I think that the PDF, right, I think it is that if you look at it in one dimension, it is very peaked, and there are a couple of, you know, there's a sample here and a sample here or something like that that's drawing it out there, whereas it's definitively cut off
right
over here. Yeah.
Each of these are making use of the whole data set, right? You're just slicing it or wrapping it at different time scales effectively to produce these. So,
exactly.
So how correlated are subsequent points? Like, I mean, how much should we think about this blue band as kind of being a fit through the fat regions of each of these, and how bad a thought is that?
Yeah, one of our major problems. So let me start with the gray points, because you can say, okay, well, how can I construct them to be uncorrelated? Well, if I take this to be 1 over t, 2 over t, 3, et cetera, so you have integer numbers. In 1 over t, then they should be uncorrelated, except for the fact that how do you define the time span t of your data set? Because you can define it as the overall span from the first measurement from any pulsar to another measurement of any other pulsar, but that may not be the same pulsar. And so we've observed pulsars at different times. They've come in and out. And so there actually is a little bit of leakage, but I think there's been some tests that have done with some cutting where there's going to be a little bit of correlation between them, but not too intense. For the power law, I mean, in respect, you're completely correlating it because you're defining them to be exactly that shape. Those are just the black dashed line is a very basic model for if you just have gravitational waves from supermassive black hole binaries with no other environmental considerations and they merge, they come together beforehand, so there's no stalling, they've solved what's called the final parsec problem, they've come together and now they're just evolving and merging due to gravitational waves. That's the expectation, and then our power law measurement is in the blue posteriors there.
Yeah, they also assume a very particular population model, right?
For the black dashed. Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Which is only marginally consistent with the 13/3 value here. So it is in many respects, it is sort of similar that you can see that the blue basically threads through the gray. That also tells us that there's not as many. You know, it's a little bit of a diagnostic. There's not a lot of problems here at the lower frequencies. Now you might say, well, what about the higher frequencies? Well, one, yeah, at higher frequencies, there's lots of problems that we are very aware of that come into play. So basically, all of our statistical significance, though, was always going to be at the lower frequencies, because if you think about having some white noise level. Right, the part that's going to pop out is going to be the part at the lowest frequencies. Those are always going to be the ones that show up first, above our white noise level.
So defining the auto power spectrum, or instead is it showing the part of the power spectrum that has a quadrupole Helling-Zhou like angular?
I forget. I think this is just the auto terms.
Okay, so then
sorry. This is definitely just the auto terms in this plot. Yes. Yeah.
So this thing then will be the sum of whatever gravitational wave background, as well as like white noise from the pulsar.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. And then, so let's see. So the other piece of this. So that's one piece of the evidence. So hopefully you all believe that there's the same kind of noise in all of our pulsars. And the other part of this is getting to the Helling-Zhou curve. So this plot here, this is our reconstruction. We've put all of the points, so we've binned them so that there's roughly the same number of pairs in each bin. And we've also included correlations between the pulsar pairs. So they've actually inflated our error bars, but we wanted to show that for consistency's sake. Regardless, we do lots of other statistical tests that are not just looking at this plot. The Bayes factor for getting this Hellings-Downs correlation is, depending on what we do, 200 to 1,000. Whereas in our previous data set, it was a Bayes factor of 2. So sort of like saying 2 to 1 odds in our previous data set. But that has really grown in this current data set. And when we do various null distribution tests, so we actually get down to the various p-values, we come up with p-values in this range here, which if you translate into Gaussian is sort of like a 3 to 4 sigma, again, depending on the test that we do.
That the angular resolution was something like tens of degrees, is that right?
Yes.
So therefore here, I should imagine that they have maybe like 3 or 4 like independent points, is that right?
It's probably more than that, but not significantly more than that. Yeah, this bidding is totally for show. That when we go into the statistics, it doesn't care about. There is no bidding that comes into play here. Yeah, we have talked a lot about what the that's the resolution, but we're still measuring the isotropic power across the whole sky. So. Maybe I'm not understanding the.
We're measuring the angular correlation.
Yes.
The ability to measure that is set by the angular resolution, isn't it?
So that this curve is for an isotropic background. Is that
this curve is for, yes, this curve is for an isotropic background. I'm not sure, maybe I'm not understanding that. If we know the exact separation between the pulsars, though, we know exactly where it should fall in correlation space here, how correlated they should be. So regardless of regardless of what the power is on the sky that it looks like and how.
The ability to localize like individual gravitational wave sources, right? You know.
Sure.
I wouldn't be able to measure this, could I?
Yeah.
There's the inverse correlation of this. Pulsars, and then there's the underposition of the source. Is that the coefficient? Those are two different things.
So shouldn't those be related? Shouldn't my ability to measure this cross correlation?
This sounds like a great conversation to maybe have after the talk.
Yeah, we'll chat. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So this you're telling us this Bayes factor of 200 to 1,000 for this model, and you said that you also consider other potential polarizations or other theories of gravity. Mm-hmm. So what's the next Bayes factor that you guys got?
Depends what we do. So I'll show some of them. I don't have the polarization test in here. I should have put those in here. There is one. It's the scalar tensor mode, I believe, which has a Bayes factor of something like 30. And that's very interesting, but we've managed to localize, we've managed to see that this is coming from several pulsars. And so we think that it's a mischaracterization of our noise, which is inflating that Bayes factor. Right? If you start taking one pulsar out of the array and then you can do the check, you know, you're jackknifing everything. If you take out, I think it's like two pulsars, the Bayes factor reduces a lot, and that seems very problematic. Obviously.
Yeah, it's interesting that theory you mentioned, because that theory could have pulsars that have scalar rays and many others that have not. So,
sure.
So it could very well be true. That's what I'm saying.
You're right. It could be. We just didn't want to go and say we found.
Sure.
we found the alternate. We found the deviations from general relativity. We weren't about to do just that just yet. Okay. So that's the evidence. So hopefully I've convinced you that we have our evidence, and it is fairly solid. So what is the last couple of minutes I want to just spend on the science that we get out of it? So this is a sort of representation of the 2D posterior for the spectral amplitude and index. But we've simplified it to just talk about models where if you look at simulating or synthesizing populations of galaxies, and their environments. And if you have more massive or more binaries, they're going to increase the amplitude of gravitational waves. And if you have fewer binaries or less massive, they're going to decrease the amplitude. And then you talk about what the interaction is like. So this is related to the slope of that power law process. And so you have all of these different models that we've simulated, and then we have our data set posteriors there, which is not incredibly constraining at the moment. So we know that lots of different models are consistent with the parameters that we have, but all the more reason that this as the first step, we want to localize those regions that of parameter space so we can really start to understand what's going on in the environment within these supermassive black holes. I'm going to skip that. And then I also want to say that what we've learned in the last several years, though, is that while we have evidence for gravitational waves, and we set out to do this because we expected to see gravitational waves from supermassive black hole binaries, which is what I've been talking about this whole time, there's nothing in the evidence that I've shown which tells us that it must come from supermassive black hole binaries, which is a little unfortunate, but that's how it goes. So one of the other things that we had done was to look at what we call areas of new physics. That is, if any one of these were true, if you add in some new physics to the standard model, then beyond the standard model, then they would finding that would be evidence for such a thing. And so we have lots of different models which are also consistent with our gravitational wave background. That is coming from inflation, coming from types of scalar dark matter, coming from cosmic strings, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are many that are not consistent, so we go through this paper and show that there are many that are not consistent, but there are, in fact, a number that are. And so likely what is true is that our signal is some combination of one or more of these. From prior knowledge of seeing lots of supermassive black holes, or seeing lots of galaxies merge, we expect that there's lots of supermassive black hole binaries which should be merging. So we expect that most of our signal should be from that. We don't actually know that for sure. The one case where we can test that is by trying to map the low frequency gravitational wave sky. So these are maps of the anisotropy upper limits. So we have not detected anisotropy just yet. And so at individual frequencies, you can see what our upper limits are looking like. And we're at the level, our upper limits are at the level where you expect there to start being anisotropies just due to local structure in the universe. So we haven't detected anisotropy yet, but we expect that our sensitivity is such that we should be able to, and are hoping to be able to, perhaps even with our next data set, given that we're right at that level. If we find anisotropy, or find it and then are able to constrain how much power is in the anisotropy, that would tell us that we are definitively seeing supermassive black hole binaries, and we'd actually be able to correlate that with the large scale structure locally to us. So stay tuned for that.
Just because you managed to see anisotropy that lines up with global structure, does that automatically make it supermassive black holes?
Yeah, we've had some discussions of this. It doesn't actually even have to necessarily line up with large-scale structure, because you could have, for example, a single source that starts out unresolved and becomes resolved, and that could, you know, that could be 100 megaparsecs away in some random direction, right? So it could be that it doesn't entirely line up. And so the question is, can you get cosmological things that produce these kinds of anisotropies? And this is not my area of expertise, but my understanding from these discussions is not at this amplitude that you would be able to see. So if we see any of these things, if you see anisotropy at the level, or you know, close to the level that we're putting upper limits on now, that should be from supermassive black hole binaries, because otherwise, you know, think about the anisotropy in the CMB. I mean, if it was 1,000 times larger, you know, you'd say, okay, well, it's something else. It's the Milky Way, for example, or you know, it's the dipole motion of the Earth. So it's things like that. So if we see it at this level, it's hard to come up with it's hard to come up with cosmological sources at the 20% level, anisotropy level. Yeah. Okay, and then the last few slides I want to mention are about one future facility that we're really, really aggressively pushing towards, and that's called the DSA 2000, and the Deep Synoptic Array 2000. And it's the idea is that it will be made of 2,000 of these 5-meter dishes. Turns out that is the cheapest way to build an Arecibo-class observatory that doesn't involve a giant hole in the ground. And it turns out that's also more expensive than building 2,000 of these dishes, of which nanograv would get about a quarter to a third of the time. So it would really expand our operations in the future. We've just put in a number of major, one federal proposal, and then we've been talking with private partners. The idea is that it would sit, the current best site right now is what's called Hot Creek Valley. So you'd have all of these dishes over this many kilometer long circle in the middle of this valley. And that would really, really, really improve upon our science. It would allow us to observe many, many more pulsars for a lot longer time with more radio frequency, so the measurements themselves are better, with more collecting area, so the measurements are also better from that regard. That'll allow us to constrain the shape of the gravitational wave spectrum, so not just this power law, but actually looking at deviations and bends. That'll get us both towards understanding the environments of supermassive black hole binaries and potentially new physics, and really looking towards, how many times I have said that? Okay, well, there's a giant internal that you can't even see. But basically going towards single sources in the future. And that we expect that, so this line here says by 20 nanograv in 2036, and then there's with the DSA 2000. And these are the 95% limits that we will have detected some number of binaries. So we expect that within a decade, we should have detected at least one binary, but it could be that we detect one in the near future as well, right? The 50% chance that we detect one will be only in the next couple of years. So there's a 50-50 chance that we will see our first supermassive black hole binary by the end of this decade.
Timescale for supermassive black hole binary merger? It's like it was on the order of like seconds.
But by the time they're actually bound, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of years, something like that. Yeah.
Right, but like the actual merger event, like does that last an appreciable longer time than we're used to with LIGO?
Yes. It's also it's out of nanograph's frequency band. Oh, okay. It actually becomes so high frequency that LISA, once it goes online, will see the chirp signal like LIGO sees the chirp signal.
How much time in between being in your band and then going into LISA's band?
Oh, that's the hundreds, like 100,000 years. Yeah, so we will not, people will see a LISA source evolve into the LIGO source band and then merge, which will be absolutely incredible to see. I am not expecting to be around long enough to see a nanograv source evolve into the LISA band, unfortunately.
If you have very massive binaries, you could maybe potentially.
Right. Then there's a rarity problem among these. So nanograv can actually detect the mergers. We can detect the memory signal. They're called bursts with memory. So you're detecting the memory offset. So after they chirp and then they ring down. They don't ring down to zero. They actually are offset. And we are much more sensitive than LIGO is at detecting memory. However, the events are much rarer. So they are detecting all of these mergers. They can't see any individual memory signal, so they have to statistically stack all of them up. And once you have something like 2,000 of them, you can distinguish it. Whereas we should be able to easily see a burst of memory if it happens in this century.
But don't you marginalize over like the p dot and p double dot, et cetera, for each pulsar?
Yes.
Yeah, so then shouldn't that make it harder to see the sort of, no?
Actually, no, because it's such a strong signal. Yes, you do have to fit that out, but it turns our residual start to look like this ramp function. I actually had this one here. So you do actually have to fit this out. And so instead of this ramp, if you fit a quadratic, you get kind of like a kid's drawing of a bird. It looks exactly like that. But this ramp keeps going for so long that that just becomes real. It just becomes really dominant to see in our data. So if the event happened, we would see it, and we would we actually have constrained memory events out to gigaparsecs, not having happened. But you know, that's the problem. So it's one of timescales. Yeah. So if a very massive one merged, that would be exciting. But again, you have to wait a while for the chance of that to happen. All right, and that is it. And I will take any other questions.
Thank you, Michael, for a very clearly stimulating talk. I think we have time for one or two questions that haven't been asked yet.
I was curious about the SIA 2000. Mm-hmm. At the time this setup, wouldn't you, ASCA, Mirka, cohort really competing that much?
No. So the one of the many miracles of this DSA 2000 concept is exactly how fast you can start producing this. That they I've seen the latest pictures of the forming of the dishes, that they want to crank out several dishes a day. And so actually construction will be really rapid in comparison to lots of these other things. So if we got funded today, like if we started with funding and stuff right today, we would see first light in maybe 2 years. Like really rapid, yeah.
Are these fixed?
Yes, they are fixed.
Yes. This might be a stupid question. So instead of correlation between two points, is it possible to do higher order correlations between multiple points?
Between multiple pulsars? The answer is yes, because I've seen those papers, but I don't actually know what that buys you. It probably does buy you something, because I have seen those papers. But yeah, I'm just not sure.
All right, so given the time, let's thank Michael again, and then people can stick around and converse. All right, thank you.
Absolutely.